lashed him throughout our state, and perhaps make recommendations to reform it. And we've certainly talked about many of these things on this program, but we've never really focused in on the basics, something as basic as just what constitutes mental illness. How many different forms are there? How are they diagnosed? How are they treated? And what is the record of success with those treatments? We're going to explore those questions and more this hour with Dr. Keith McCoy, Senior Vice President and Chief Clinical Officer and Medical Director of Cardinal Innovations Healthcare Solutions. They run managed mental health care for Medicaid patients in 16 North Carolina counties, including this one. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning.
Victor Armstrong is Vice President of Behavioral Health at Carolina's healthcare system, responsible for 66 inpatient psychiatric beds, the Psychiatric Emergency Department, and provider-based outpatient programs. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning.
And Dr. Robin Hurley is Associate Chief of Staff for Research and Academic Affairs at the VA Medical Center in Salisbury and a professor at Wake Forest School of Medicine. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Those statistics that I just pointed out, the fact that we've had a spate of mass shootings that seem to have been perpetrated by people who have had mental difficulties. And just, I think, last week or 2 weeks ago, we did a program in which it was revealed that a lot of young people in school today are being reported as having mental problems, and which would be anxiety problems and things like that. What's going on here? Are we actually seeing an uptick in mental health issues, or just is it just the lay of the roll of the dice recently? Are we actually seeing something going on here? I'm not sure who to take that question to. Go ahead, doctor.
Sure. Well, it's difficult to know if the specific violence that we see is associated with an uptick in behavioral health disorders. We are seeing increased screening, increased detection. We obviously have more opportunity for within social media for people to become honestly marginalized and have more access to other people's plans, to other people's thoughts when it comes to violence, so that they're not so much on their own. Mm-hmm. So I think that there's a way that interconnectedness might actually bring, in some ways, some additional isolation, but also access to information that other people might not have had before. We do see, again, there are certain stressors that come with society the way that it works. Certainly, families being more and more torn apart, and the stresses that come along with that, increased trauma. And obviously from the VA system, we're going to see a lot of folks that are coming back with severe trauma and surviving with that. We've also been through some economic stress and things like that, right, that might have put people under a greater level of stress, which might bring out a behavioral health disorder that might otherwise not have occurred.
The governor has kind of said he wants this to be the friendliest state in the nation to veterans. And if he's being successful in welcoming those, we are talking about a considerable number of people who have been in combat and been in very bad situations for a number of years now. Are we seeing an increase? Are you seeing an increase in patients who need that help because of those experiences, Dr. Hurley?
Well, we have not seen an increase in violence among veterans,
right,
if that's what you're asking. But in general, we certainly are making a lot of efforts to bring our veterans to us for medical care. And one of the things that we do is we always are screening for mental health issues. When a new veteran comes in, we have several required screenings that are done at their first primary care visit, which I think is done in many systems now. So we always look initially when a new veteran comes to us, are they having issues with post-traumatic stress or depression or anxiety, substance abuse. We always ask about suicide. You know, those are always things that we're careful to really be mindful and to look for in the VA.
You kind of oversee, Victor Armstrong, the Carolina's healthcare system, psychiatric system. Essentially, you run 66 beds. You have run the emergency department, outpatient programs. Have you seen an uptick in the need for your services in the last several years?
Well, I think there are a couple of ways to look at that, because one of the things I think that we do need to speak to is that there is a certain amount of sensationalism that's mm-hmm. attached to anytime there's a mass killing, mm-hmm. and the immediate response is that it occurs as a result of mental illness. And in reality, the number of people that die every year from mass killings is minute compared to the folks that die in one-on-one killings. So I think that because of the sensationalism, I think we overstate a bit what's going on with the mental health population, that they're portrayed as being out of control, and when the reality is that people who live with mental illness are much more likely to be victims of violence than they are be perpetrators of violence.
Why?
Well, they're more vulnerable. They don't always have the wherewithal to know when they're in danger. So they're more likely to be targeted as victims than they are to be perpetrators of mental illness. The average person dealing with mental illness is not violent. Mm-hmm. You know, we get a lot of our perception of the mentally ill from the media, from the movies, or from the things that we see in the news that are garnering more press than some others. So in terms of whether we're seeing an uptick in the amount of mental illness, I don't know that we're seeing an uptick in the amount of mental illness, but we are seeing more attention right now to mental illness.
Well, then let's talk about what constitutes a mental illness, because it's not just people going off the deep end. It's people who are having trouble coping. They may be depressed. They may have anxiety issues. Talk about what constitutes a mental illness.
Well, the way that we view it in neuropsychiatry, I'm a practitioner of neuropsychiatry, is that it's a problem in the body, in the brain, that's a chemical problem or a neuroanatomy problem, a problem in the brain, just like a broken leg or a problem with your liver or your pancreas that needs attention. And mental illnesses are illnesses that affect one's ability to think, to feel, emotions, behavior, thought processing, any of those things, nervousness, anxiety, as you mentioned, are a couple of examples. And it all comes back to, you know, the brain is an incredible organ with millions and millions of neurons and billions of connections. And there can be chemical problems with some of those connections in the brain that lead and exhibit what you see as the symptoms of mental illness.
We keep hearing in the media, at least, that we live in extraordinary times and that we've been through a tough period economically. We've just recently emerged, but still a lot of people are on the precipice of not being financially secure. And people seem to be connected now 24/7 to the world at large and through social media. They know what's going on in their friends' lives, and sometimes that can be a stressor. It may not just be an entertainment thing or an information thing. It may be, oh, he's doing better than I am. What's wrong with me? Is that exacerbating the smaller mental health issues?
I believe so. I think there's been some studies about behavioral health issues that are associated with the fact that we're inundated with positive information about other people's existence and are only fully aware of our own, which has got to be a balance of positive and negative issues. Mm-hmm. So there's a sense that when we are inundated with that positive information, that we always assess ourselves as somehow less than other people, which can become kind of a vicious cycle in and of itself. I think the other thing that's important to know when it comes to behavioral health symptoms is the challenge of figuring out what's a normal variable when it comes to mood and what is something that creates impairment. And typically within the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, functional impairment is a huge piece of detecting, all right, this is getting to the point that it would be a disorder rather than a normal variant.
I think it also speaks to the fact that when we're talking about mental illness, the vast majority of people that deal with mental illness are people that are dealing with stressors, day-to-day stressors, that impair their ability to carry out their normal lives. What we tend to think of when we think of mental illness are sociopaths.
Right.
Or we tend to think of the person who walks down the street in the middle of summer wearing several layers of clothing, talking to themselves. And that's not the average person dealing with mental illness. The average person is just as Dr. McCoy described.
So it seems to me that it's probably difficult to spot. It's difficult for the person who is suffering from this to recognize it in themselves. It may be difficult for their families to figure out what's wrong. If they think there's anything is wrong. Would that be accurate? And if that is accurate, how many of us are walking around with what might be the equivalent of a mental cold or a mental toothache?
I think that there is an accuracy there. I think that we all struggle at various points with feelings of anxiety, of feelings of sadness, but when does that become a disorder?
Mm-hmm.
I think that things can begin subtly, and then when things don't get better, you may have people surrounding you who want you to just get over a lost job or something else, and there may be a normal time period where you experience some distress over that. But when it begins to be to a degree that it creates an inability to sustain relationships, sustain vocation, to fulfill your normal responsibilities, to take care of yourself is when you really need to begin to wonder, is this something that I need to seek treatment for on an urgent basis?
When people come to the three of you, are they coming mostly on their own volition? Are they coming at the urgent at the urging of family and friends? Or are they coming because in the course of talking to people about various things, you have diagnosed that they have an anxiety disorder or they have depression or something else? How do they come to you?
It depends on the context that you work in. So I do some clinical work at Rex Hospital in Raleigh one day a week, and a number of people are coming through the emergency room involuntarily. So they did not come on their own volition. Others do come on their own volition because they're experiencing a crisis where they believe that they're unsafe. I also do inpatient consults where I'm dealing with people with dementia and delirium who have behavioral health problems that are tied to longstanding cognitive impairment or physical health problems that are creating cognitive problems, such as delirium. And often those people don't come volitionally. For those that are in more of an outpatient setting, it's often going to be a voluntary process.
What about Carolina's healthcare system?
We get a little bit of a lot of different things because we have a variety of services and a pretty large continuum on our campus. We do get a lot of folks in the emergency department who are involuntarily committed, meaning that they're deemed to be a threat to themselves or others, and they're often brought in by law enforcement under an involuntary petition. But we also have people that come to us to our outpatient programs voluntarily or because they're being prompted by family members or people who care about them to seek services. And I think that in part what we see, because we do see so many people who come to us in so many different ways and for so many different reasons, I think that in part the reason that we see so many folks that do both here and Rex and other emergency departments across the state that present at the emergency department is because the other piece I think that we're seeing with behavioral health is that we're paying the price for not having the services in the community that people need in a way that people can access those services so they don't reach the point of needing to go to an emergency department.
Mm. And at the VA?
Well, certainly we have a lot more outpatient than inpatient, and the great majority of our patients are voluntary. Certainly we accept committed patients when there's need and there's danger to oneself or others, but the vast majority, if you look at our nation and look at our veteran population, it's folks seeking care on an outpatient basis for the stressors that we've talked about earlier, or for chronic mental illnesses in which, you know, they have a longstanding relationship with a mental health practitioner who sees them ongoing to adjust their meds and to get them enrolled in a psychotherapy program.
Dr. Robin Hurley is Associate Chief of Staff for Research and Academic Affairs at the VA Medical Center in Salisbury and a professor at Wake Forest School of Medicine. Victor Armstrong is the VP of Behavioral Health at Carolina's Healthcare System, and Dr. Keith McCoy is Senior Vice President and Associate Medical Director of Cardinal Innovations Healthcare Solutions. They run a lot of the healthcare systems in the county, 16 counties around North Carolina. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Black Hawk Hardware, located in the Park Road Shopping Center, locally owned and mismanaged since 1977. Black Hawk, where hardware, home, and garden meet. Info at blackhawkhardware.com. And Sedgefield Interior Landscapes, specializing in interior plant design, installation, and continuous maintenance for businesses. Information available at sedgefieldinc.com. Election season is underway next Tuesday. Early voting has already begun, but next Tuesday, Charlotte voters go to the polls in the mayoral primary. Lots of Democrats, a couple of Republicans, and tomorrow on this program, we will take a closer look at the candidates and the issues and what some of them have been saying as they've been on the campaign trail. That's tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, Congress returns to Washington with a full agenda, the Iran nuclear deal, fiscal deadlines, and a visit from the Pope, the very long to-do list for our nation's lawmakers this fall.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon, after Charlotte Talks, on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Let me give you the correct title for Dr. Keith McCoy. He is Senior VP and Chief Clinical Officer at Cardinal Innovations. I demoted him. Sorry about that. Didn't mean to do that. Also with us, Victor Armstrong from Carolina's Healthcare System and Dr. Robin Hurley from the VA Medical Center in Salisbury. We want to hear from you as we go through the program. What do you think about patients' or families' rights in the mental health care system in North Carolina? We haven't gotten to that topic yet, but we will eventually in this program. So you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter to get your opinion out about that and or ask any questions you may have as we go through the hour. Governor McCrory just a couple of days ago announced the creation of a mental health task force to examine the mental health care system throughout the state and, if necessary, make recommendations to reform it. Do the three of you see a need for that task force, Victor Armstrong?
I do. I think that it is high time that we do have a task force in place. The one thing that I would encourage the governor to do, though, is to be sure that we have consumers of behavioral health services on that task force to speak to it from the consumer and family perspective. But I definitely believe it is time that we have a body to oversee the delivery of behavioral health services in North Carolina.
I'm never going to find the list of people in my notes here who are on that task force, but I know a Supreme Court justice is on the mm-hmm. task force. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if one of the people that you're talking about is. I could be wrong. Do you see the need for it as well?
Yes, I do. I think everything that we can do to decrease the stigma, to get folks more aware of that this is a medical problem, that it does need treatment, that there are wonderful evidence-based treatments out there, mm-hmm. and everything that we can do to help people that are suffering with mental health is a good thing, and it helps to prevent future problems.
So when the governor talks about the mental health system in North Carolina, is he talking about the public mental health system, which would be funded through tax dollars and would have patients coming in who are on Medicaid or on some sort of assistance, or is he talking about the private mental health care system?
I would assume it's all of the above. And what's important about that is, and I think where a lot of the resources need to focus are on prevention, early detection, and early treatment. There's a lot of disability that we can actually prevent if we can do that initial prevention. I think about school systems especially, really investing in school system behavioral health detection and treatment. I also think about those who are the most severely and persistently mentally ill and the fact that we haven't tied housing recovery-oriented housing to what the treatment model looks like. We're very limited in the public system.
We actually have in Charlotte. We have one model of that in Charlotte, which is, if you believe their track record, has been very successful.
More Place. Yeah. So actually one of my best friends growing up, Liz Clayson Kelly, is part of that with Urban Ministries. And it's a phenomenal model. Local fundraising, but they've had 80% reductions in the population that they've served year over year for jail days, arrests, hospitalizations, and emergency room days. And these are people who are incredibly chronically homeless and mentally ill, so 10 plus years on the street usually.
The exact title of the governor's task force is the Task Force on Mental Health and Substance Abuse. How closely are those two things tied together?
Well, they're tied very closely together, and one of the things that we know is that the comorbidities between the two go hand in hand, in many, many cases. And if you treat the substance abuse, then the underlying mental health disorders or mental health disorders coming from the substance abuse can get better. One of the things that you mentioned about the programs to intervene earlier in recovery is that we know now that, it used to be that you had to get sober before you could go into housing.
Right.
Now many programs, including some with the VA, are showing that if you get the housing secured and the safety of a person first, like you mentioned, Victor, earlier about the safety of mental health of patients, then they tend to do better, that get better from the substance abuse easier. It's in a safer environment.
Well, it would seem to me that although it's probably apparent on the face of it, we don't see it because we don't think about it. But if you haven't got a place to sleep at night,
right,
you're not going to be you're going to be completely absorbed by that and nothing else. And it would seem you can't be healthy in any way.
Right. And how are you going to say, just get sober for, 30 days or whatever mm-hmm. the time frame for the individual program is? You can't if you're worried about survival. And
right.
You're
we find that at our place that one of the leading indicators of readmission into our inpatient facility is homelessness. Mm. And so we have actually just recently begun a partnership with Urban Ministries and working with them around trying to figure out how can we on the one end make it easier for people who are chronically homeless to enter into behavioral health services, and on the other end, when we're discharging people from our facility, how can they help us with those folks and getting them the services that they need? And I think it speaks to the point earlier about the need for a public-private partnership, and I think that's the only way we're going to be successful.
In his reasons for putting together the task force, the governor says that mental illness and substance abuse disorders are among the biggest health care challenges that our state will face over the next decade. I see you agreeing with that. Why is that so?
Well, the impairment that results from it due to the cognitive impact that often people have means that those who suffer from these disorders have a much harder time maintaining housing, maintaining relationships, maintaining jobs, which just compounds the degree of societal impact. They're often, because they may struggle with housing, maybe more likely to be arrested and stay in jail. So it's not just spending that happens in the behavioral health system, but spending that happens throughout the entire system that is being affected by the degree of the problem.
You know, since our days of deinstitutionalization in the late 1960s, since then what's happened is we went to, you know, all of these outpatient models of care. Well, our jails have become the de facto long-term mental health problem, and that's very, very costly.
When do these problems usually begin to exert their influence on people? Is it in your childhood years, your teen years, your young adult years? Is it after some – I know in some cases it's after a severe trauma, particularly with soldiers and others who have been through horrible, disastrous situations. But in normal situations, when do the seeds begin to be sown?
Well, it really varies on what the condition is, you know, whether it's a thought disorder such as schizophrenia versus a general anxiety versus an obsessive compulsive disorder. It really, really varies according to what the condition is. I mean, something like autism would start, of course, very, very young. You know, it depends, you know, mental illness. All of the mental illnesses cannot be bucketed into one bucket. You got to think about them as different kinds of illnesses.
Mm-hmm. We often think of it as people having a genetic predisposition, and the genetic aspect of behavioral health disorders is very strong, especially for things like bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, really any mood disorders. So what happens is there's often a genetic preloading, and then there's an environmental trigger that occurs. There are certain sensitive times, such as schizophrenia. So for males in the late teens, early 20s, for females in the 20s to early 30s, and then for females, there's another bump around menopause that creates an opportunity for a chronic psychotic disorder. And so there may be a stressor that brings about that genetic predisposition, and then you'll see the consequence of that.
I know this depends on what kind of condition we're talking about, but what's the most prevalent form of treatment? Is it usually sitting down with a psychologist or a counselor? Is it drug therapy through a psychiatrist? Is it something else?
Well, it certainly depends on the condition, as you said, but you know, most of us believe that it takes both to really get a patient well and to keep them well, keep them sustained well. We have great medications that are out there to reduce more of the physical symptoms that you feel of the illness. Plus, there's wonderful evidence-based psychotherapies out there to help people make sustained change in their thinking patterns and in how they view the world. You know, one of the things is, are you constantly viewing the world as the old cliche, you know, half the cup, half empty or half full, in a sense. And there's wonderful evidence-based therapies, and the VA is leading the way in many of those.
It matters whether you see the world half empty or half full?
That was a cliche yes, to show how one thinks about the world in terms of your emotional view. You know, do you view things always very depressed? Do you view things more in a happy way? Mm-hmm. And that's all in your cognitive processing. And what we know is that you can change those neurotransmitters and you can change those pathways in the brain with medications and therapy. There are wonderful imaging studies out there that show that psychotherapy can make those long-standing changes in the brain so that you process in a much different way.
How long a process is that for most people?
It really varies according to how much the person, how ill they are, how much they put into it, what their genetic predisposition is for illness. Are they taking medicines? Are they not? Are they, you know, are all those other factors we talked about in their life stable? Mm-hmm. You know, again, you can't focus on any of these if you're worried that you're homeless and, you know, where's your next meal coming from?
Yeah, if you have a course of illness where you have remission and relapse, this is going to be a lifetime process. Some people may experience one significant episode mm-hmm. that was effectively treated with a cognitive behavioral therapy where you mostly work on cognitive restructuring, and that impacts the way that you emotionally respond to the world. And, you know, there are those who will come out of treatment and think that they're totally stable and then have another episode and need to come back into treatment.
How important is early intervention to the ultimate success of the treatment, Victor?
I think it's extremely important, and I think it's taking on a bit of a different look now with integrated care. I think the more we get into integrating the medical and behavioral side, the better job we do of some early intervention and preventive type measures, because then we for example, Carolina's Healthcare are about to initiate an integrated care project with pediatric physicians. Mm. And so you get an opportunity then to intervene a little earlier, to look at more preventive measures, and hopefully then you can offset some of the things that would lead to more severe and persistent mental illness down the road.
You know, we don't talk in broad general terms usually about physical illnesses. We will focus in on cancer or we'll mm-hmm. focus in on some other anomaly, but we lump mental illness and put it up on this shelf and talk about it as a group thing. But I would wager, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that all of us get colds. We all get viruses. We probably all slip into and out of various stages of mental health, don't we?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I think earlier, you know, Dr. McCoy mentioned that, you know, all of us have some element of anxiety and depression in our lives. You know, things are not always perfect all the time. But I think one of the things to remember is when it becomes a problem, just like you said earlier, in terms of, you know, how's your functioning? How's your relationships? Are you able to get to work on time? Are you coming in late every day? You know what? It's looking at the global picture of what's going on and seeing when those symptoms become distressful to you, to the family, to folks say, hey, you're changing, what's going on, you know, and then, of course, most importantly, are there thoughts of suicide? You know, that's the most awful thing that we want to prevent. And like it's been mentioned earlier, early intervention is the key. We know that from our medication studies. We know that from all of our studies where, in fact, most programs now, including I know CMC and I know you guys in Cardinal, and we are embedding mental health inside of primary care mm-hmm. just so that you can intervene early and stop it before it gets to the point that it's a chronic mm-hmm. problem that is harder to fix.
There was for years a stigma attached to mental
yes.
illness and to mental and getting help for that mental illness. You would be loath to do that, and particularly in the military, where that could ruin your career if you sought help for a mental problem. Has it become less so in the military? And as soldiers return to civilian life who have been through significant trauma in the wars we've been conducting for 10 or 12 years, are they more apt to seek care today than they might have been after Vietnam or after Korea or after World War II?
Yes, absolutely. There has been a lot of work on many, many fronts, both with the Department of Defense and with the Veterans Healthcare System, to reach out and say you're not alone and this is a problem experienced by many. And to be able, we've done a lot of work educating commanders in the field of how to notice when there's problems and how to go and seek care. Now, yes, there are still certain things that can be a challenge for careers, but we're doing everything we can, both in the VA and in the Department of Defense, to try to alleviate that as
should
much
it be,
as possible.
Should it be a challenge for careers?
You know, that's not something that I can really speak to, because I'm not in the position of trying to decide, is my force healthy enough to go out on the front lines and stay in a combat situation, for only a commander or a general can really answer that at the time. But what I can tell you is that mental illness is treatable. You know, your person is certainly healthier and better off having treatment than suffering with an illness and not telling anyone about it and continuing to go to work every day. You're much, much better to get help and get treatment.
You say it's treatable, and CHS Behavioral Health says it is recoverable. It is curable, essentially.
It is. I mean,
in all cases or most cases or some cases?
Not in all cases. I think that if you asked any 10 people the definition of recovery as it relates to behavioral health, mm-hmm. you get 10 different answers. I would define it as a person being able to do the things that are important to them that they enjoy doing to the best of their ability.
Right.
And I think that what happens too often for individuals with mental illness is that because of the stigma attached to mental illness, they don't always seek the services that they need. They don't always disclose to employers what kind of supports they need in order to be successful in the workplace. And I think that leads to more pressure, more stressors, and just exacerbates the problem.
Should they disclose to employers that they have special needs or that they have a a mental illness of some sort that requires certain concessions be made?
If we were talking about a physical disability, any other physical disability, there would be the stipulation in place that this person has to have.
But they're protected under the ADA, the Americans exactly. with Disabilities Act. Is the same true for people with mental health issues?
Well, I can't really speak to the specifics of the laws around mental illness, but it is an illness and should be under the same protections. And I would defer to my colleagues here who may be more well-versed mm-hmm. in exactly how the laws speak to that.
Dr. Hurley, go ahead.
Sure. Yes, it is. It is protected under the Americans with Disabilities. But you know, you also have to realize this is your private and personal medical conditions. And you know, we don't always go into our boss on the first interview or first visit and say, "I have these six medical problems." You know, that this is your private health care. Your private, just right. the same as getting treatment for a diabetes condition or liver, high blood pressure. I mean, how many people on their first right. job interview go in and say, you know, to their prospective employer, "Hey, I just want you to know I've got high blood pressure and high cholesterol and I eat too much French fries." You don't say that in the context of job interviews.
And I'll give you another example of the complexity of it. We have, and more you're seeing in the behavioral health field, peer support specialist, certified peer support specialist, which is someone with lived experience who works in the healthcare environment and helps to work with other folks who are going through mental illness. And we have peer support specialists embedded in our inpatient unit. But there's still the issue that being a person living with mental illness is one of the requirements of being a peer support specialist. But what happens then if that person who has disclosed mental illness wants to go and work in a larger system or wants to go and work in another environment? Are they going to receive that same type of support because of their mental illness? And I think that's not the fault of that individual. That's the fault of society and the system that we're in now, that we don't have those supports in place.
Where do patient rights intersect with employer rights and fellow employee rights to know that you have a situation and I have 15 seconds?
I think, you know, Dr. Hurley brings up a good point. It needs to be treated like any other physical illness. So the degree that your fellow employees have a right to know that you have cancer, which is they don't, is the same right that they have to know about your mental illness.
We have to take a break. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Tyndall Subaru Gastonia. Test drives are available for the new 2016 Forester SUV with EyeSight technology that sees problems and initiates action to help avoid trouble. Details at TyndallSubaru.com. And the Iron Yard, existing to create growth and mentorship for people and their ideas through tech-focused education. Enrollment available for 12-week courses dedicated to teaching code and more. Information at theironyard.com/Charlotte. Congress returns to Washington with a full agenda, the Iran nuclear deal, fiscal deadlines, and a visit from the Pope. On the Diane Rehm Show in 20 minutes, a look at the very long to-do list for our nation's lawmakers this fall. That's coming up at 10. If you'd like to join our conversation, now's the time. You could email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter. And we are coming right back.
It's your world. We help you explore it.
Is any country in Europe putting out the welcome mat for these refugees and migrants?
Well, Germany is, and this is, I think...
It's your community. we help you understand it.
With NCMS, a higher percentage of schools got A's, about 12%. But just like the state, about a third got D's or F's.
Morning Edition on WFAE is an essential way to start your day and stay connected to your world. Listen weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about mental health in North Carolina, and we'll be talking about how you get care and who provides the care. And we have two people who do just that with us, three people who do just that with us. Dr. Keith McCoy, Chief Clinical Officer with Cardinal Innovations Healthcare Solutions. They are in charge of mental health care in 16 counties, including Mecklenburg County. Victor Armstrong is Vice President of Behavioral Health at Carolina's healthcare system, and Dr. Robin Hurley is the Associate Chief of Staff for Research and Academic Affairs at the VA Medical Center in Salisbury, and she teaches at Wake Forest University Medical School. We wanted to hear from you. We asked a social media question. What do you think about patients or family rights in the mental health care system in North Carolina? We're not getting a lot of comments about this, but we are getting these comments. Justin on Facebook, the definition of normal always changes when it comes to mental health. Under today's definition, I'm sure I could be pegged as crazy. However, I just think differently. In a culture that focuses on individualism, we cannot even start to help those whose thinking may lead them to violence or unhappiness until we focus on community building and togetherness. I'm not sure there's a response there from the panel, but I just wanted to put that out there. Daniel says, can anyone talk on how for years funding for public mental health programs has been cut and just not considered important by our politicians, just treating it as another way to save tax dollars by cutting the funding? The biggest cuts I can recall were the ones that were pushed by President Reagan in reference to veterans. Are we doing that?
We're not cutting treatment for veterans at this point. In fact, we've been doing everything we can to build it up for the last several years. You know, one of the things we've done is add new mental health providers in almost every VA in the U.S. There's a Uniform Services Mental Health Package that Washington put out for us that tells us exactly in each VA and each community clinic how many psychiatrists you need to take care of such amount of patient population, how many psychologists, how many social workers, and that's the same throughout the nation. So the VA has been doing absolutely everything we can to hire practitioners, to put them in, embed them in primary care, to be able to offer all of the evidence-based therapies that we can for veterans to treat them. And we have done a tremendous ramp up since the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq began.
Have we been cutting funding generally to the public at large for people who need it for mental health care?
So the question comes into looking at per capita. So in North Carolina, on the public side, we have funding sources through Medicaid for those who have Medicaid and funding sources for those who are poor but lack insurance. And I think per capita, we've definitely been decreasing for those who are poor but lack insurance. And though I do think the state's done a lot to try to do some specialized funding to increase crisis system care, but again, we really want to get towards prevention and early treatment. Within the Medicaid system, the MCOs like Cardinal, we're capitated, and we've been able to create.
And that means what?
Capitated means that the state gives us a set amount per member per month for those of who have Medicaid and assigned out of one of our counties. And we have to manage within that. And if new services are added, the capitation goes up, and generally services are not removed. What we've been able to do is every year that we use those funds more efficiently, we're able to create new services that allow us to expand access and to treat more people, and we've been successful with that.
We have a Twitter comment that says, we closed mental hospitals and opened prisons. Somebody's already alluded to that. Actual care is only available to the well-off. You would disagree with that?
I think we actually have a very robust treatment service array within Medicaid, and we've done everything that we can to ensure that people have as easy access to that as possible. We have a number of comprehensive community clinics in each of our counties where people can walk in and get an assessment pretty much at any time. They may have to wait a couple hours, but they don't have to have an appointment, which means mm-hmm. It can be available when they're able to get transportation and be able to get there.
What impact has the Affordable Care Act had on mental health care and for those who fall in what is called, I guess, the Medicaid donut hole within that in North Carolina, has that had an impact?
Yeah, the donut hole is for Medicare, and it has to do with medication affordability.
Okay.
And
so has the Affordable Care Act increased access to mental health care?
I believe so. It's obviously somewhat handicapped in North Carolina because we've not expanded Medicaid. And so the Affordable Care Act doesn't provide subsidies for those who are at 100% of poverty or less. And so those people don't have the ability to get insurance off of the exchanges, but were intended to get Medicaid. And in North Carolina, we've chosen not to do that.
And what has the impact of that been? Or do we even know?
Well, I think one of the most important things, and Victor, you can speak to this, is on hospitals because of the way that funding streams, there's certain DSH payments, disproportionate share payments that hospitals were given from the federal government to help them pay for the uninsured are beginning to go away because the intention was for everyone to be covered. And because North Carolina doesn't have coverage in that way, the hospitals are vulnerable, and we've seen some hospital closings.
And so essentially what's happened is that hospitals have had to bear the cost of the Affordable Care Act but have reaped none of the benefits in terms of the uninsured now having Medicaid. But what has also happened, I think, is that in part, I think it's a little bit deceptive because there's been over the years so much change in the delivery of mental health services that even when there have not been substantial or significant cuts, it appears that services have been cut because the way we deliver services has changed from having kind of a one-stop shop 10, 12 years ago to services being now provided by private providers as opposed to where it used to be that the public system provided behavioral health care. So I think that the public's understanding of how to access care has changed some too. So I think that has an impact. But I would add that to Dr. McCoy's point, one of the things that hospitals are learning, I think, more and more is that it is cheaper to treat behavioral health than it is to ignore it. Carolina's Healthcare, for example, opened their 66-bed hospital in Davidson a little over a year ago, in part because it just makes more sense for us to acknowledge that you need to treat people who have behavioral health issues as opposed to having them walk into acute care medical facilities.
But if you're not reaping any of the benefits of the Affordable Care Act, that sounds unsustainable to me. How long can you keep this up?
We would like not to have to keep it up. We would love for this state to expand Medicaid. But I think in part we are learning also the economics of providing care. For folks who have a mental health issue in addition to a medical issue, the cost of their care goes up exponentially if that behavioral health issue is not treated.
Cardinal has been in business for, I think, 40 years, but under a different name earlier. But the legislature decided a little while ago to turn over control of the funding for the public health mental health care system to you. And that was kind of a controversial move in some circles. You've been charged with providing care, but while keeping costs under control. How challenging has that proven to be?
We've been successful at expanding care and expanding access while also bending the cost curve for every year in our existence of managing the Medicaid waivers, which is what we manage care underneath. And we've been doing that for about 10 years when it comes to that capitated system. And I think that we've seen a stabilization in our markets going from an unmanaged system to a managed system where people have a better sense of where to go. Mecklenburg is our newest county. We've only been doing it here for a little over a year.
And even some people who were opposed to the takeover by your organization of the Mecklenburg County system, they have said that things have turned out a lot better than they thought they would. But how do you keep costs down without lowering the level of care?
So we have a number of options. One is we have care coordination, and we have an access center, and we have people that can go out and engage people who are falling through the cracks to try to get them into services before things get worse. So it's a degree of prevention in order to try to get people into care and adherent to care earlier so they can move towards how they define their own recovery, which generally means, like Victor said, job, family, schooling, the sorts of things that help them be productive in society in the way that they choose. We also, for more restrictive levels of care, do prior authorization. And part of the reason for that is there is a tendency for systems to want to put people in overly restrictive levels of care. You know, people may want a child out of their home and so want to put them in residential care when there are more than adequate services to wrap around them in order to keep them in their home. And children have a right to continue to live close to home, go to their school, keep their same friends. And the system is actually sort of a check and balance in place for overutilization of overly restrictive services. And we've been able to reduce out-of-home placements substantially.
So here in Mecklenburg, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, you replaced MechLink.
Correct.
How has that changed the customer experience, the person coming in for healthcare?
For people in Mecklenburg County?
Yes.
Well, they have a new number to call, and I think it's important to say what our access number is, which is 1-800-939-5911. We'll get you to a qualified professional or a licensed clinician in our 24/7 access center. So if you
say it again.
1-800-939-5911. It's our own 911, and we want people to be calling hours when there's not a physical health emergency, which may need response within 5 to 10 minutes, but rather there may be an urgent behavioral health need that can be
responded
to.
But who should call? Is it anybody in the county can call you, or is it people who are on Medicaid only that can call you?
So actually, the majority of our calls are actually more for information, mm-hmm. so they don't result in we need to screen someone, triage them and get them referred to the right level of care. Mm-hmm. And so we are able, though we would encourage people to use our website and other things so that we can get people to call in who really need the assistance. But folks can call our call center in order to find out what resources are. We do get a lot of people who have routine needs, so something that needs to be addressed within the next day to 14 days, so within 2 weeks, and urgent needs, which is about 48 hours. The average response time that we would expect for someone with an emergent behavioral health need is under 2 hours.
I would think, Dr. Hurley, that people who have mental health issues need rapid response in some cases, and not to cast aspersions, but the Veterans Administration hospitals around the country have been recently revealed to be notoriously slow in their response to patient needs, and some people waiting a year or more just to have that first appointment to see a doctor in general, not just mental health. And it may not be a problem with you, but it has been across the country. How is your track record on seeing patients in a timely manner who need your care?
Well, any patient can come into our emergency room anytime, 24/7, and be seen. We have a psychiatrist who's in our emergency room. So if a patient comes in, they can be seen and comes into our emergency room. The psychiatrist can see them in the ER, and she's there during the daytime hours, and there's always a psychiatrist on call 24/7. So we always have the ability to treat someone in an emergency. One of the things that's important is that, you know, if you're talking about a rapid response, the Veterans Administration has a crisis hotline. That's anyone that's a veteran that's thinking about hurting themselves or a family that's in crisis needs to call that number, and we will get them instant help.
But if I'm a veteran and it's determined that I need long-term psychiatric or psychological care, I would benefit from that. Can I get access to that in a timely fashion in a VA hospital in Salisbury or anywhere else in the country today?
Well, yes, you can.
Is that my only option? As a veteran, could I go someplace else and get that care and have the VA take care of the money?
Well, yes, you can, but there are individual nuances to those rules. You know, the most recent rules state that, you know, if you live too far away or if the wait times are more than 30 days, then absolutely we have the ability to pay for it on the outside. But I want to come back to one point that's important, is that if a veteran has an emergency or has an urgent health care issue, then they can call our Veterans Crisis Hotline and get help instantly. And that's 1-800-273-8255. 1-800-273-8255.
We'll put those numbers on our website, both the Cardinal number and the VA number as well. I would imagine that not all people who are suffering from mental illnesses or from behavioral issues see themselves as having a problem. They may not see a need for services themselves. They may actually try to refuse services. Can they? What are patient rights when it comes to that?
they certainly can refuse services unless, and what North Carolina requires those of us who practice behavioral health is we're held to a standard when it comes to keeping our members safe as well as the community safe, that if there is, because of a mental illness or substance use disorder, a clear danger to self or others. Or in North Carolina, we also can have people committed due to predictable decline. So a predictable, in the past when they've gone off medications, we've seen things go to a place that leads to dangerousness. Mm-hmm. Then we can have someone committed for forced treatment. Within the hospital setting, there are more nuanced rules when it comes to forcing medication. And that might be a little bit beyond the scope of what we're talking about. But forced medications are also an option at times.
Cheney in Fort Mill says, can your guests maybe touch on the differences between treating adults with mental illness and children with mental illness?
I think family systems is one of the key things. For everyone, making sure that the family has good access to psychoeducation and understanding how to interact in the life of the person who has a behavioral health disorder. But particularly with children, almost every evidence-based practice will have a substantial family treatment component.
Mm-hmm. Tweet from Keith says, if Governor McCrory really wants to improve mental health care, he would expand Medicaid under the ACA or Medicare under the ACA.
Medicaid.
They say Medicare, but it's actually Medicaid. People get that confused. I get that confused.
Yeah.
Do you agree with that?
I think expanding Medicaid is a very important option that I hope that our legislature seriously considers in order to make sure that we're able to get services to some of our most vulnerable and some of our most sick people.
They say, the governor says, we have to fix Medicaid before we can decide whether we can afford it under the ACA. Have any steps been made toward that in 5 seconds or less?
I believe that the governor now believes that a lot of those issues have been dealt with and addressed.
I have to stop you there. Dr. Keith McCoy with Cardinal Innovations, Victor Armstrong with Carolina's healthcare system, and Dr. Robin Hurley with the VA Medical Center in Salisbury. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. Our producers are Aaron Kiever and Tim Ross. Our engineer is Joey Sprinkle. For more information about archives, upcoming shows, and podcasts, or to continue the conversation online, visit our website at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks.
And support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Blumenthal Performing Arts, presenting Ben Folds performing his concerto for piano and orchestra, including new songs that combine pop and classical worlds.